restaurants. Sedeh Gebrselassie, an attorney with the National Employment Law Project, says filing lawsuits or working through state or federal labor departments can bring results, but both approaches often take years.
That's why there are, in recent years, a lot of state and local governments that have taken it upon themselves to pass additional laws to try to guard against wage theft. So whether it's a law that's, you know, there are some laws now in cities across the country that will actually revoke a business license or suspend a business license for businesses that are repeat violators of wage laws, you know, as a way to really provide an effective deterrence against committing wage theft. And there are other localities that make it easier for workers to file claims.
Repeated calls for comment left for Goodfellas owner Gennaro Iannacone were not returned. Law students from the Worker and Immigrants' Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School are representing the six workers currently suing Goodfellas in federal court. They are awaiting a judge's ruling on the defendant's motion to dismiss their case, and in November participated in mediation talks at the State Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities regarding the workers' claims of discrimination on the basis of race, national origin, and sexual orientation. Given the length of time needed to investigate and pursue wage theft claims, the full effect of the new law and its tougher penalty may not be apparent until the State Department of Labor publishes its statistics for the current fiscal year. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, December 31st, 2015. Israeli troops shot and killed a Palestinian youth, and U.S. Treasury sued over donations for settlements. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Thursday a Palestinian young man near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Hassan Bizro, 22, was driving his car near the Beta Junction close to Beta Village near Nablus when Israeli soldiers opened fire at his car, killing him. The Israeli army claimed that he tried to hit soldiers with his car when troops shot him. The circumstances of Bizro's death remains unclear. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, the number of Palestinians killed by the Israeli army since October 1st have reached 142, including 27 children. The ministry added in its report on Thursday that the Israeli army have shot and injured more than 15,710 Palestinians since October. In related news, the Palestinian Commission for Civil Affairs announced on Thursday that the Israeli army would hand over the bodies of 10 Palestinians who were killed last month by Israeli soldiers. The bodies of Palestinians killed while carrying out attacks on Israelis have been withheld in line with a decision made in October by Israel's Security Cabinet to return the bodies on case-by-case basis. In other news, a lawsuit has been filed in the U.S. court seeking to stop non-profit groups from sending billions of dollars worth of tax-exempt donations to support illegal Israeli settlements and the Israeli army. A group of American citizens filed the suit on December 21st against the U.S. Department of Treasury, claiming about 150 non-profit have sent an estimated of $280 billion U.S. dollars to Israel over the past two decades. The lawsuit claims that certain non-profit groups, including the Felik Family Foundation, FIDF, Friends of Israel Defense Forces, American Friends of Ariel, Gosh Etzion Foundation, American Friends of Har Homa, and Hebron Fund directly contributed tax-exempt to violations of U.S. law and international law, subverted U.S. foreign policy, and contributed to countless crimes and human rights abuses targeting Palestinians. The Treasury Department, which has 60 days to respond to the lawsuit, declined to comment on the issue.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We do encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast has been Ryan Fritcher, Doug McVeigh, Joe Meyer, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Sam Bowman. And our engineer holding everything together is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Emily Young. Coming up tomorrow morning, New Year's Day, on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, we hear a special program hosted by Kristen Yount on How to Adult, Tips and Hacks for a Happy New Year. At 9, we'll hear the Albina Ministerial Alliance's press conference about Wednesday's court ruling on the reinstatement of Portland police officer Ron Frashauer. At 9:30, we'll hear an update on the status of Mumia Abu-Jamal and an interview with Miko Peled on his book, The General's Son. At 10, we hear the program Syrian Tragedy, Causes, Consequences, and Options, a talk by Professor Zunis. At 11, it's Radio EcoShock featuring Tim Flannery, Australian scientist and author of The Weathermakers, on his new book, Atmosphere of Hope. Thank you so much, KBOO members, for your generous support during 2015. Until midnight tonight, you know, you're going to double your pledge. If you pledge down, go to KBOO's website right now, kboo.fm, and click where it says Donate Now on that tip jar up in the corner. Happy New Year!
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Over 100 people a day have filed comments with the United States Trade Representative's Office about the impact on United States workers of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Dr. Margaret Flowers with Flush the TPP spoke with KBOO reporter Robin Ryan about the international agreement and the debate over who is most likely to benefit from its passage, as well as the hushed manner in which the window for public comment has been opened.
Earlier this week, the United States Trade Representative's Office opened the window for public comments about a single section of the mammoth deal known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That window is going to close, as I understand it, on January 13th of next year. Is that a typical time period for folks to weigh in?
Actually, this wasn't something that was widely publicized because we have our alert systems letting us know when things happen related to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We received notification that starting December 28th, they would open up this public comment period through January 13th. But I don't think it was really something that they wanted the public to know about or to comment about. I think it was really much more for their industry insiders to try to make their official arguments that would go on the record. So this was news to us. We're pleased to see it and glad that we can make people aware of it, and that already hundreds of people have filed official comments with the USTR in just the first few days.
I did go check the website for the United States Trade Representative, and the most recent press release issued by them is on December 23rd. It does not appear to be related to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so I'm wondering by what means did they make that information public?
If we hadn't been looking for, you know, things of this nature, we would not have seen it. They certainly didn't go to any lengths at all to let the public know that this comment period was available. The public comment period is restricted. They're asking for comments on the impact of the Trans-Pacific Partnership on employment, which is unfortunate because it really impacts everything that we care about, from our health care to our food safety to the environment, financial regulation, you name it. And so at least we do have this one opportunity to be able to tell them about the negative impacts of the Trans-Pacific Partnership on employment. And we try to make that easy for people to do through Flush the TPP, which is our TPP campaign website, has step-by-step instructions as well as links to information about the TPP, how it impacts employment, and a sample comment for people if they need something to help them get started.
Both the Center for Economic and Policy Research and Public Citizen have reviewed the applicable documents. Can you share some of the assessments on this aspect of the agreement?
Like I said, this is a very broad-reaching agreement. It goes way beyond trade to really impact everything we care about. But just looking at the impact on jobs and the economy, the Center for Economic and Policy Research looked at the Trans-Pacific Partnership and estimates that it's basically going to be a wage reduction for most workers, that those who make the very highest incomes will see a rise in their income, but that for pretty much everyone else, except those at the extremely lowest end, we'll see a drop in wages. And, you know, this happens because we're basically opening up our outsourcing of jobs, which includes more than manufacturing. Now we're going to see service jobs outsourced and financial jobs outsourced to countries where the minimum wages are as low as, you know, 65 cents an hour. So there's just no way that workers in the United States or companies, you know, can compete with those low wages. And then we will also see something called insourcing, where many more workers from outside of the country will be brought in to work in foreign subsidiaries of their companies here in the United States. And there's a concern that that will also drive down wages in the U.S. as well as displacing jobs here. So we'll see outsourcing of jobs, and we'll also see what we're calling insourcing of jobs, bringing more workers into the U.S. And then in terms of worker rights, we'll see a reduction in protection of worker rights as corporations can sue in a tribunal or an extrajudicial kind of court outside of our court system that is run by corporate lawyers, and they can sue if our policies to protect workers interfere with their profits. So the only people that are going to benefit from the Trans-Pacific Partnership are those who run transnational corporations, and for the rest of us, it's really going to be bad news.
There is another group that on December 2nd drafted a letter for the President of the United States, and their contention is that this agreement consistently does not meet the objectives identified by Congress in the Trade and Policy Act of 2015. That was Trade Promotional Authority, right?
Right. That was part of what was called Fast Track or Trade Promotion Authority. It was kind of a very unusual process. In the past, what Fast Track has been used for is a way for Congress to set out limits for the president to say, okay, if you're going to negotiate a trade agreement, here are the parameters within which you can negotiate, and initially set out as a way for them to set tariff levels, because that's what trade agreements are really normally about. This time, the Obama administration started negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership years before it even got any kind of authority from Congress to do that. But when they finally did get that authority in July of this year, just before the negotiations were concluded, Congress did set out about 150 or so what they call negotiating objectives that they expect the Trans-Pacific Partnership to meet. And once the text of the TPP was released, many of us are seeing that, it doesn't meet guidelines such as protecting workers, protecting the environment, protecting our economy. Now, what that means going forward is to be seen, because we expect that the president won't send the legislation for the TPP to Congress unless he sees that he has the votes to pass it. And when Congress set the bar within the Fast Track legislation for what it would take for them to take away Fast Track, they set that bar so high that I think it would be hard for them to achieve. So we're not sure if these negotiating objectives are going to be anything more than things that people can complain about but won't really result in anything being done about them.
As I understand the Constitution, the powers given to the legislative branch include commerce with foreign nations. And I'm wondering, are you aware of any lawsuits filed charging Congress with an abdication of its authority to give the executive branch permission to negotiate with the foreign nations?
Through the Fast Track that happened, it started back in the early 20th century, where Congress did give the president the ability to negotiate within very strict parameters. It was basically, okay, you can negotiate trade with such and such country, and we will allow you to negotiate tariffs within this specific range. It was a very specific kind of authorization that they gave. And then that was really convoluted and corrupted in the 1970s by Richard Nixon. And, you know, onward from there, we saw it during the Clinton administration. legislation with NAFTA and the WTO that were passed under Fast Track, where they basically really expanded the scope of what these agreements do. And now the Trans-Pacific Partnership is even broader, impacting internet usage and all kinds of patent protections and environmental and financial regulation and things like that. In reality, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an international treaty. It's not a trade agreement. And under that, then Fast Track should not be allowed, and the Senate should have to have, I think, 3/4 majority in order to ratify it. But it has intentionally been not called a treaty. It's been called a trade agreement, and so they've circumvented that. I think the problem is it's hard to get, and I'm not a lawyer, so maybe the lawyers out there could think on this a little bit, but I think it's very hard to get legal standing to bring a case against this whole process. And the best we can hope for is that we stop it and it doesn't pass. But if it does get passed, there may be some grounds for legal challenges in the future, which would prevent future abuses like this.
Do you know if the State Department or the USTR intends to provide the public with a schedule for future public comment periods?
No, I don't think that that's going to happen. I think this was an unusual situation that they were asking for input on the employment impacts. And again, I don't think that they expected the public to be aware of it or to get involved in that process. The only other report that I'm aware of is one on the economic impacts that needs to be done and sent to Congress. I don't think that we'll expect other public comment periods coming down the road. What's important for our listeners to understand is that President Obama will be legally allowed to sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement on February 4th, but that does not put the agreement into effect. The next step after that is that legislation needs to be sent to Congress, and the White House has been drafting that legislation, which puts in place all of the various laws to make the TPP become effective as it's written. And this is really another thing that people should be upset about, because the Trans-Pacific Partnership being negotiated in secret by industry lobbyists is basically rewriting our laws, that our laws have to be brought into compliance with whatever types of policies they have within the TPP. So one big one that is really upsetting a lot of people is the ban on what's called Buy American. So if the federal government, one of the agencies, is procuring goods or services, they can't give preferences to companies that are in the United States. They have to give equal